I'm Melinda Linderer Huff, director of the Milton Historical Society, and I'm so happy that you've decided to spend some time touring our beautiful little town. Using Milton's significant collection of historic buildings and the Broadkill River as a backdrop, our tour will introduce you to the rich history of this small community. I hope that as you listen to the stories of Milton and its residents, your imaginations will soar, and you will visualize a town with a multi-layered history and an extremely promising future. But before you start out, let's talk a bit about the building that houses the Historical Society. It was built in 1857 as a Methodist Protestant church and held services as the Grace Methodist Church until the late 1950s. The building was renovated in 1906 when the stained glass windows and bell tower were added. In 2006, the Historical Society membership and community came together to raise $600,000 for the renovation of the building. Significant rot necessitated the replacement of the foundation and floor, as well as the replacement of siding and roof. The bell tower was rebuilt, and an entirely new wing devoted to storage and exhibition space was added onto the south side of the building. Jack Hudson is a board member of the Society. His family owned and operated a hardware store in downtown Milton for many years. He gives us a first-hand account of changes to the building over time.
It was originally called Grace Methodist Church, and there were two Methodist churches in Milton. There was a Grace Methodist Church, and then there was a Goshen Methodist Church, and the Goshen Church is still here. And what happened was that back in the, middle to late 60s, the Methodist Conference determined that there was not enough room in the town for two Methodist churches, and one of them was going to close. The Grace Church was the small church, so they closed it, actually padlocked the doors, and it made a lot of the people that went there very upset. And some just shrugged it off and went to the Goshen Church and forgot about it. But a large group did not, and they actually formed their own church, which is still here today on Union Street in front of the cemetery. And after the conference padlocked the doors, it just sat there for a long time. And then there was a gentleman who rented it by the last name of Foley. And back then, of course, the Vietnam War was really hot, and he made parts for walkie-talkies for the armed services, and he did a lot of cable work. And in the church part now, that's the museum, there were long workbenches set up in there, and he had quite a number of employees, and they soldered parts and put cables together. And some of us boys worked there for a short time, not long. And then over where what's gone now, but where the social hall was, which is now where the meeting room is of the Historical Society, he sort of used that for an office. And then after he left, in 1972, I guess it was given to the Historical Society to form a Historical Society. So it's amazing that for what happened to that building after it stopped being a church, that it really survived the way it did.
When you leave the Milton Historical Society, take a short walk south on Union Street until you reach the Union Street Bridge, previously known as the Red Bridge. It's at the head of the Broadkill River, the waterway that dictated the town's location and its early economic direction. As you stand on the Union Street Bridge facing the Broadkill River, you might want to think about Milton's first settlers. Not too many years after they arrived, the Broadkill became a popular site for the shipping and shipbuilding industries. Wealthy sea captains and merchants, ship carpenters and sailors all made their homes here. Today we will walk the four main streets where they lived and worked: Union and Federal, running north and south, and Broad and Mill, running east and west. These are the same streets that, now, form the core of our town's historic district, designated on the National Register of Historic Places. Containing 198 structures, the district's boundaries are said to contain the finest surviving close concentration of residential and commercial architecture in Delaware's Sussex County. Russ McCabe, director of the Delaware State Archives and vice president of the Milton Historical Society, is going to tell us a little bit more about the Broadkill and why it was so attractive to Milton's early settlers.
Beginning in the 1680s, people followed those rivers inland and settled first along the rivers. Why? because of the same reasons the Native Americans had considered the rivers to be so important. They were the backbone of the transportation system. They gave them an outlet to trade and an outlet to food sources. So the first European settlers who came to this area proper, who settled on the Broadkill River, for instance, the first settlers were forced inland because you aren't going to settle in the marsh. You can't take an ox cart loaded with grain or shingles that you've rived out of cedar trees and pull them to a wharf across a marsh. You can't do it. So settlement very quickly in the 1680s began to push inland here on the Broadkill River because that first half of the river bank, if you will, was not sturdy, was not stable. The first European settlers to receive tracts of land, and certainly by the late 1680s there were more than one here, had settled in this greater area of where Milton is today on the Broadkill River. Milton as a community would exist 5 miles west of here or 5 miles east of here if the highest point of navigability was 5 miles east or west. That's literally why it's here. Again, geography guides where man goes and what man does with the land. If you were to come into the Broadkill River 300 years ago, 200 years ago, or a little less than 200 years ago, you couldn't have gotten any further up the river with a boat than literally right here, right where this bridge is right here. That was, so that proved to be an advantage for Milton.
Beginning at the northwest side of Union Street, we will now head west towards Mulberry Street. As we proceed on the brick pathway called Governor's Walk, and later on Mill Alley, make sure to note the historical markers for Delaware Governors Samuel Painter, David Hazard, Joseph Maul, and James Ponder, all of Milton. There is also a marker for Joseph M. Carey, a son of Milton who served as governor of Wyoming. Let's stop midway along the walk, where we'll hear more about Milton's early history. Pausing on Governor's Walk, we'll listen as Russ describes how hard it would be to exaggerate the prosperity and prestige that the shipbuilding industry brought to Milton.
Why in a 50-year period did a little town like Milton have four men who served as governor of the state of Delaware? Because of our economic importance here. As our country became, you know, a major exporter, our exports grew, there was this major demand for vessels. So by about 1820, vessel building concentrated here in Milton. Why? Just the reason we've talked about already. Furthest point of navigation, up the river, closest to the raw products, the wood that would be used to construct the vessels to the west in the center part of the peninsula. So it was literally the closest place to get that stuff here to construct the vessels. You had the younger sons who needed work. You had a demand nationally for the product. And by about 1820, a majority of the vessels being built in Milton really was this epicenter of shipbuilding. By then, most of these vessels were being built for export purposes. They weren't being built for trade to and from Milton, for instance. And they grew tremendously in size, and they continued to grow. The largest vessel constructed in Milton, or in Milton shipyards, which was built in the 1880s, was roughly, if you can imagine it, the length of a 17-story building in height. These things were, by the time this industry reached its peak, these were vessels that were being constructed for the transatlantic trade. So again, what happened here, basically, was it wasn't by accident. It was literally a result of geography, topography, and the growth of our population. Labor source, product, demand, physical location. And that's what really created the Milton that we know today. I mean, you go up and down the streets, and most of the buildings that were, most of the houses and some of the businesses that are still standing today were all constructed during that time period when Milton was literally this at the center of this tremendous economy.
We'll continue on Governor's Walk until we reach the Mulberry Street Bridge. Let's stop for a few moments when we get there. From the Mulberry Street Bridge, we have a good view of the picturesque pond that was created when the Broadkill River was dammed in 1815. We'll talk about the importance of the pond to Milton's economic life a bit later. But for now, the pond underscores the importance of water to Milton's community life. Joe Black and Martha Jane Donovan Burke remember the fun they had on the pond when they were growing up.
You went in the mill pond every day.
Yeah, we'd
did a lot of swimming down at the mill pond. No bathing suits. Well, we had a spot down in back of where, you know, where the funeral home is. It's directly in back of it where we did most of our bathing.
Yeah.
We had stumps that we named out in the pond, like the one we would go out to most, was called New York. We could swim out there and back. We were considered pretty good swimmers.
The current weir that's there now was a lot different. It was an old set of wooden gates. That's where all the guys would, not all, but a lot of people would swim there. And up here in the upper pond, going up that way, was where all the boys would go if they cut school and swim. And it was called, pardon my choice of French words, Bare Ass Beach. And it had a rope and a knot and a tire out there, and you swung out over the trees and dropped down to the lake. A lot of people learned to swim over there on that mill dam, and they would just jump off. It wasn't like it is now. At one point in time, it was utilized for water skiing, and we almost had to leave on weekends because it would just start early in the morning and go till Sunday night dark. That's when Mr. Wagaman owned the pond, and he would take care of the level of the water in it himself, and he basically took care of the lake in terms of lowering and raising the gates and lowering them and all that kind of thing. And then when he sold it, Joe Hudson bought it. And Joe had it for a long time. And then finally the state took it over. And that's when it became a recreational facility for fishing. And they put a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit on it. And they stock it. And it has a fish ladder over there now. So it's a different purpose. And they do take better care of it than one individual could do.
As we get on our way again, we'll walk south along Mill Alley through Milton's newest park, stopping for a moment midway to talk about the debate over the town's name. A statue of the poet John Milton was dedicated here in December 2008. Now that you're in Mill Park, feel free to rest on one of the benches and view the sculpture of the poet John Milton. Many think the town bears his name, but others aren't so sure. Actually, the town has had many names over the course of its history. First, Osborne's and Conwell's Landings, then Greencorn, Federal Town, and Head of the Bronze Kiln. In 1807, the villagers asked the Delaware General Assembly to name the village Milton. An outstanding debate is over whether the town was named after the poet or called Milltown in honor of Milton's many mills. The first mill was established upriver from here in about 1710. Mill Alley itself serves as a reminder of two other mills. The pathway is located near the site of a water-powered flour and grist mill owned and run by the Wagaman family until the 1960s. It is also a reminder of a steam-driven sawmill that was located across the street. When we finish our walk along Mill Alley, we'll be on Federal Street. This will give us our first in-depth look at the Milton Historic District. Standing at the corner of Federal and Coulter, we're reminded that Milton's architectural history is the only real remnant of the town's heyday as a port and industrial center. If you look east toward the Federal Street Commercial District, you'll see many of the town's finest mid to late 19th century homes. We'll take a closer look at these later in our walk. Experts think that the preservation of Milton's housing stock was determined by economic decline. Russ McCabe tells us more about the loss of the booming shipbuilding industry.
But what happened by the 1880s, a couple things happened. There's this kind of stereotypical, and I hesitate to use that expression, but I can remember more than one person telling me when I was younger, well, you know, the shipbuilding industry in Milton died because of steam. Not so. If you were to go to any of the ports, of New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, in the 1920s, you would be shocked to find the number of sailing vessels that were still being used then. Why? Because it was far less expensive to own and operate a sailing vessel as late as the 1920s. I mean, steam had been around for darn near 100 years, but it wasn't steam and metal vessels that ended this industry here so rapidly. And it did. And there was a description in the 1880 census about the shipbuilding industry here. And it's just overflowing with praise about, you know, what a wonderful thing it is economically, how many people are employed, 3-4 shipyards, ships on the stocks, and things were just booming. By 1890, the business had virtually ceased. But it had very little to do with that shift to steam power. What happened was, again, a result of geography and available resources. Two couple things, basically. One, we finally ran out of shipbuilding material. All that great hardwood forest was gone. In its place grew those wonderful holly and pine-covered forests that we think of today, because it grows up faster. Then the second thing happened. Remember we talked about the fact earlier that as people settled here, the first places they settled were closest to the water. And the first thing that they did was they cleared out the trees. And that continued back away from the rivers and streams. That was the settlement pattern. Because then you could grow a crop there and you could sell the wood. What happened when the story, runoff.
From here, turn right and walk back to Mulberry. We'll cross the street and stop for a moment at Goshen Church. Although the physical location of Goshen Church has moved several times, the church itself has a long history in Milton. It was established here in 1801. Aside from its role as a place of worship, the church is a reminder of winter's past. Several Miltonians remember the wintertime activities that took place near the church.
In the wintertime, where the Goshen Church is, the hill, Mulberry Street, they didn't use salt the minute the first snowflake came down. They closed that hill off as far as Magnolia Street, and at nighttime, when it's sledding there, that was a lot of entertainment. And the pond would freeze over. They'd have fire out on the pond, and some would skate. And it we'd hurry and get the lessons done, so we could go up on the hill and go. And they didn't, they closed it off until the snow was gone so that kids could do that. Like I say, today children don't know with the sledding. They really don't know how much fun. And it didn't cost anything. If you didn't have a sled, somebody was gone down the hill, you jumped on, belly flopped them. And it was good. Yeah.
In my lifetime growing up, there were a lot of gentlemen that were phenomenal skaters, which leads me to believe that it froze quite a bit when they were younger. Because they used to come out and skate. One man came up to me one day and said, could I please skate across the lake with you? And it was like having some professional ice skater drag me across the ice. When it would freeze, people would come. We would build fires inside of tires right along the edge. And that the fire company would come over and supervise these things and also shine lights out on the pond because we skated at night as well as in daytime. And sometimes it would snow on top of it. And you'd have to get out and brush the snow off. You didn't have to, but it was really rough if you didn't. So we would skate out there, and just everybody would come, and people would just come and stand.
On Federal Street, just past Goshen Methodist Church, you'll run into Marshall Street. Feel free to meander down. As you stroll down Marshall Street, you'll see a summer kitchen, an old barn, a shed, the law office of Governor David Hazard, built in about 1810, a typical 19th-century farmhouse with hand-hewn cypress shingle walls, and a cottage. A button shop was located on the lane between the 1930s and the 1950s. We'll talk a lot more about the button-cutting industry later in the tour. In this area also, past the lane and closer to the mill pond, was the ice house operated by Handy Prettyman. Handy was a free man of color and one of Milton's most prominent and respected entrepreneurs in the early 20th century. Joe Black and Martha Jane Donovan Burke recall the central role that the ice house played in the Milton community.
From pictures that I've seen, Handy Prettyman had a huge ice house over in this area. And I saw a picture of this pond being froze deep enough that they would take the horses and the wagons out on the pond, cut the ice out, fill the wagon up, and go back up with it. It used to freeze a lot more than it does now.
It used to cut ice out of the mill pond and store it in the ice house that he had built close to the mill pond. He would go out there with probably another man or two and use a cross-cut saw, had the handles on both ends, you know, and they saw these chunks of ice, then put it in the ice house, and I think sawdust on top of it to preserve it, you know, so he could sell it in the summertime to the ladies around town who didn't have refrigerators at that time. They were just ice boxes.
Yeah.
I know my mother used to have an ice box. And
that's what Mom had.
When we were kids, you know, he'd pick off a little bit of ice and, you know, to chew on. He was a nice guy. Handy Prettyman called.
So Prettyman's ice house is gone now?
Oh, yeah.
Are there no
it
remnants
burned,
of it?
I think a bunch of kids, I'm not sure, but probably some armory boys or something one night went in there and set it afire. I think, I mean, that's just hearsay. But it did burn down. And he never rebuilt that I know of.
As we proceed further south on Federal Street, let's stop briefly at number 416. This is the Governor James Ponder Mansion, now the Short Funeral Home. You're now at number 416 Federal Street, right in front of the home of Governor James Ponder, the 44th governor of the state of Delaware. He served as governor from 1871 until 1875. Behind the house is the old swimming hole that we talked about earlier. Across Federal Street from the mansion is one of the town's few brick Queen Anne-style houses. The bricks were produced by Laughlin's, a local brickyard. Laughlin's brick is distinctive for its bright orange color and can be found in several other early 20th century properties around town. After you take a look, continue up Federal Street until you reach Abraxas Studio of Art at number 515. The structure at 515 Federal Street was built about 1820 and is a good example of that period's vernacular style. Feel free to go inside and visit when the studio is open. Then follow Church Street until it meets Chestnut and turn right. You'll arrive at the Rising Sun Lodge number 4, 516 Chestnut Street. Rising Sun Lodge, the structure you're facing now, was built as a Presbyterian church in 1834 and served as a school in the late 1800s. In the early 1900s, it was an African-American Methodist church. It was purchased by Rising Sun Lodge No. 4 in the 1930s. The lodge is affiliated with the Prince Hall Masonic Order, founded in 1775 to serve men of color. A small graveyard behind the building dates from the early 1800s. Jack Clark, the lodge historian, tells us more about the lodge and its founding.
So Prince Hall Masons were strictly a black organization, chartered from England for the black people. In fact, he was one of the Revolutionary War heroes or fighters, you know. And he petitioned to start this lodge, Prince Hall Lodge, and that's why it's called Prince Hall Masons. We've got the original charter and everything. We've got the original charter for this lodge, too, from 1853. Back in the 1840s, the men of color were going to Wilmington. Were working out of Wilmington. There were no jobs around here, and the people that could travel went to Wilmington to work. And there they started to learn about Masons, because the Pennsylvania Masons had a lodge set up in Wilmington so that the brothers could learn about the lodge, about Masons. Mm-hmm. So what happened is Grandmaster at that time, in the Pennsylvania Grandmaster, chartered the first lodge in Delaware, which was in Wilmington. That was called Star of the East Lodge. And in 1852, the men in the lower Delaware who were working in the Wilmington area at that time, they became interested in Masonry. So they petitioned to have a lodge set up in Milton. And then they looked out, and then within a year they had a lodge set up in Milton. And the first lodge hall was a personal home. And from there it grew and grew. It took off, I'd say within 10 years span.
Directly across the street from Rising Sun at numbers 515 and 517 Chestnut Street, you'll see two identical Victorian Gothic style houses. Cross the street so you can take a closer look. The homes you're now viewing were owned by the McGee brothers, ship captains who built the houses side by side in about 1875. Note the scrollwork ship wheels in the upper cross gable. The Victorian trim built on many homes constructed during this period may be the work of ship carpenters who spent their off periods building houses. We don't really know how large a factor ship carpenters were in the development of the town's architecture, but we do know that Milton has a wider variety of late 19th century housing than any other town of similar size in Lower Delaware. Right behind the McGee properties, you'll see Dogfish Head Craft Brewery. Tours of the brewery are available. Call for dates and times. As you look at the modern brewery, it might be hard to imagine the old Draper King Cole cannery that used to be housed here. The cannery was built in 1902 and purchased in 1907 by Harry R. Draper, who canned peas and tomatoes. In the late 20th century, Draper King Cole was the largest family-owned vegetable processor east of the Mississippi River. The cannery closed in 1999. Joe Black grew up near here, on Chestnut Street, and worked in the cannery as a teenager. He remembers what it was like.
But when I worked there, it was done, a lot of it was done by hand. You know, they didn't have the machinery then that they have now, or had even 20 years ago. I did everything from working in the fields, in the bean fields with a hoe, right out here, not too far from where we live. I think the pay was 25 cents an hour then. I remember putting in 100 hours one week when I was like 15 or 16, and made $25. I thought, all the money in the world. It was mostly just summertime work then, you know. I started in the pea season and worked through the lima bean season, and that was most of the summer. A lot of local help, most all of local help. Now, I think I probably knew almost everybody that worked there, practically. And there were a lot of people, a lot of women worked there too, you know, because like I said before, beans were put on like a belt. And they would sit there and pick out all the bad beans and throw them, you know, sorted them out before they were canned. And then they had machines that did the crimping work, like Betty was saying that they used to do by hand on the farm. Well, they had big machines that crimped the can tops then. And they'd go through a line, you know, snake through there. And I don't know how many they would do a minute, but probably 100 cans a minute.
As we head back toward the center of town on Chestnut Street, imagine a busy railroad station, which moved the cannery's goods to market. As Joe relates, the presence of the railroad made this area a lively part of town.
I don't know whether that was before the Queen Anne or whether it was during the Queen Anne line, but they used to bring horses in from the west, and there was a dealer, Sam Wilson. They had a hardware store and a farm store, and it was located right down where the Wilmington Trust Bank is now. And I remember when I was a kid, when they brought these horses in on a train and unloaded them, they would herd them down Chestnut Street when it was still dirt. And they would tame those horses some way, I guess like cowboys do. They'd break them for farm work. I remember it didn't occur too many times while I was growing up, but I'm sure it did quite a bit before I would know what it was, you know, maybe before I was born. But I remember seeing maybe one or two bunch of horses going by the house, you know, and they were taking them down to Sam Wilson's store there to eventually sell to the farmers.
By the early part of the 20th century, agriculture was a critical component of Milton's economic well-being. But farming was difficult, and labor problems were hard to solve. Gladys Wilkins was born on the farm where she still lives. She recalls that Milton's farmers have always faced tough challenges.
Had to almost go out of the farming business because there was no help when to work on the farms. When I was in school, I was telling someone just recently, in May, we would go to school Saturday mornings until 1 o'clock on Saturday, and that was counted as a complete day. But we would get out in early May so that the boys could work on farms, and then they did not have to go to school until the ending of September, because get the harvest done the fall, and they were not counted absent or anything for that time. And it was hard, you know, it was very hard.
With the onset of World War II, labor problems became even more challenging. Draper King Cole now relied heavily on migrant labor for its operation, first Bahamians, then Southern blacks, and later Puerto Ricans. The migrants who worked in the cannery added to the lively atmosphere on Chestnut Street, especially on Saturday afternoons when, dressed in their finery, they would parade down Chestnut Street to hang out at the Blue Goose, a restaurant and bar on Front Street, right across from the river. Following in their footsteps, let's continue east on Chestnut, pausing for just a moment when we reach Poplar Street. Poplar Street, our current stop, is a typical Milton lane. Here we can see a privy, a shed, and a poultry house. Don Fisher grew up close by on Federal Street. He tells colorful stories about when the chicken business came to town.
By the time the war came, University of Delaware had an extension thing over there on the Laurel Road, and they started us dabbling in broilers, chicken. And the war got underway, and rationing came into play. Meat was rationed, chicken was not. So, people, the chicken factory everywhere. Every town had chicken, and chicken houses all over. So, I mean, they like built chicken houses. There's a chicken house down the alley. Yeah, chicken house. And so, chickens, what made the chickens go during the war, as I said, was because it was an unrationed meat supply. And the market was New York and Philly. The chicken plants, you know, anybody who had a few bucks, I mean, you know, some lawyers in Georgetown or something like that, put some money together to have a chicken plant and build a chicken plant. In those days, all they did was kill the chicken and take the feathers off and put them in a box, ship the whole chicken, no evisceration then. And then they throw them in a little scoop of ice in the box, throw the chickens in there, throw another scoop of ice on top, close it up, and they didn't care if they were purple, green, or what. I mean, it was a chicken and it was going to New York City.
The next yard, at the corner of Chestnut Street and Manship Lane, is 418 Chestnut, the brick home of Handy Prettyman. Handy Prettyman's father acquired this home at 418 Chestnut Street, as well as other Chestnut Street properties, in the mid to late 19th century. He was one of many free people of color living in town at the time. Most worked as farmers, laborers, blacksmiths, bricklayers, ship carpenters, and sailors. They lived alongside whites, with the town divided more by socioeconomic class and occupation rather than race. As mentioned earlier, Handy and later his son James were quite prominent. They owned and operated their own ice businesses, serving the town from 1897 until 1968. Jack Clark shares his memories of the ice business.
Mr. Handy had a ice house. And he used to bring ice from Georgetown or somewhere, and it stored over there, and he'd sit out there and sell ice right off of that. Even before that, I guess about the same time, had an ice house, an ice trailer right beside the lodge hall. Mr. Handy and Mr. James Furman, they used to had ice crushers and everything. They would crush ice for Reed's Trucking Company. And you could see Reed's trucks backed in here, and the Furmans would be icing them down and everything. So that was a something to remember because, while we're on the ice thing, well, at home we had ice boxes. We didn't have refrigerators. And Mr. Handy would, and James both would go around town. And Mr. Handy used to do it in a horse and buggy. And of course, when the sun came up, James, he had a truck. But they would come around, and every time the ice man come, he would, they'd chip off a little piece of ice for all the kids in the neighborhood, give everybody a piece of ice, you know. I can remember those days.
Yeah, that was a treat.
Yeah, it was a treat. It's like the a snow cone or something, you know. It was fun. Yeah.
Continuing east on Chestnut Street, originally named Apple Tree Street, we see a typical mix of Milton's architecture, a cast sand house, bungalows from the early 1900s, 19th century Gothic Revival style homes, and mid-19th century vernacular houses, some modified with later Victorian elements. The town of Milton is now involved in a multi-phased project to expand the current Milton Historic District. As many as 180 structures could be added to the 198 structures that were placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1982. Structures under consideration include workers' houses, African American and Native American resources, early 20th century industrial and commercial sites, and numerous other buildings dating between the early 19th and the early 20th century, like the bungalow we're standing in front of now. The upper and lower sections of Chestnut Street are central to this effort. If you look across the street, you'll see the Golden Rule Lodge No. 17 at 315 Chestnut Street. The lodge was established in 1848 by the International Order of Odd Fellows. Like Rising Sun Lodge and Endeavor Lodge, Golden Rule Lodge was a fraternal organization significant to the building and sustaining of small-town civic life. It has housed school classes and the town's library. Now let's go south on Atlantic Street. We'll walk one short block, then turn left on Walnut Street, pausing at the Tingle House, number 313. We believe that the Tingle House, where we're standing now, was built on or before 1915 for the African-American Mary E. Tingle. The property on which the existing house stands was owned earlier by Daniel and Lizzie Oney, a free African-American sailor and his wife. The Oneys lived here as early as 1862. African-American ship carpenter James White and his wife Mariah lived next door. Let's continue on, pausing at 301 Walnut, the Lank Shivelhood House. The original house at 301 Walnut was built around 1800. It has an addition dating to about 1830. John H. Lank was a sea captain of a famed Milton seafaring family. Elizabeth Lank Shivelhood was his descendant and a local educator. As we leave the Lank Shivelhood house, we will turn right onto Coulter. But first, stop and take a look at the Goshen Methodist Cemetery. Visitors are invited to walk in the cemetery and look at the graves which date from the early 1800s. The block is also the first site of the Goshen Methodist Church, established in 1801, and of the Milton Academy, established in 1819. Milton Academy was located on the Coulter Street end. It was later the site of the Milton Public School. The church was built in the middle of the block and was surrounded by the graveyard. Goshen Church relocated to Federal Street in the 1870s and moved again to its current Federal Street location in the 1960s. As we start up again, return to the site of the Lank Shivelhood House at number 301 Walnut Street and proceed down Coulter Street. When we come to the corner of Coulter and Collins, we'll stop for a moment. We're at the corner of Coulter and Collins now, looking at a cluster of 19th and early 20th century houses long owned by the related Clark and Drain families of Nanticoke, European, and African-American heritage. As just mentioned, Milton had a strong community of free people of color, including both African-Americans and Native Americans. The Clarks and Drains were founding members of Bethel A.M.E. Church and Rising Sun Lodge No. 4 in the first half of the 19th century, and the First Congregational Church in the early 20th century. The Clark family made their living from farming, and Jack Clark has fond memories of his father's work, especially the hog killings.
Oh, yeah, my uncle, right across from my grandpa, he used to kill hogs every year. He would raise four or five hogs, three or four hogs, whatever. But at that time, different farmers would. This farmer would have a hog killing this week, the next one would have one the next week, the next one have, and just go from farm to farm to farm and help each other to kill hogs. That was a big day. They would go in and kill the hogs. I had somebody going in before light, real early of the morning, get the fires built. They had big kettles, you know. Get the kettles all hot. Dad was one of the guys that would do the shooting. That would kill them over. And then they have to bleed them out. So they would cut their throat and bleed them out. And then they would drag them over and scald them, scrape the hair. They had particular scrapers to scrape the hair off. The hide would be really clean. You know, they would wipe it down with lye soap and all that, you know. Then it would hang them on what they call a swingle tree from a tripod. And that's where they would start working on him. And cut him up and all that. And then after the whole killing was all finished, the ladies would have a big dinner for them, for all the guys. They'd have chicken and dumplings and fresh pig meat and stuff like that, you know. And that was a big celebration. And that happened almost every hog killing. And then, of course, it was putting meat away for the winter. That was their staple for the winter, you know, their meat staples. So that was a big thing, but they're very rare. You're very seldom hear them now. They do have them, but not like they used to. I would say probably maybe 10% of it. But it was mostly for family. Mm-hmm. So, and nowadays, I do know guys that go out to, community hog killings, and they might kill 6 or 8 or 10 hogs. Like 3 or 4 families come together now and do it. then they, a lot of times they go ahead and make their sausage, grapple, and other cuts of meat, and they would package it for sale. But that's not like it used to be. I was a little guy. I used to like help to build the fires and stuff like that, you know. Just being around them. And it's been years since I've been to one.
So your dad enjoyed that kind of work?
Oh, yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah. And I think a lot of times the older guys, got together and it was an event for them just to get together and shoot the hash. And
so it was social as well as...
Yeah, social as well as getting the job done.
And a great meal.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
As we turn left and head back towards the center of town, we're on Mill Street, one of Milton's earliest streets. The high end of Mill Street is in an area of town known as Puddin Hill. Mill Street parallels the river, and its location made it safe from floods and mosquitoes. Of particular note are numbers 313 and 317, since parts of both date from the 1700s. When we reach Chestnut again, we will want to take a look at number 115. In 1812, this was the only house on the entire block. Its lot was bordered by Chestnut Street, Mill Street, Walnut Street, and Front Streets. The shed behind the house was once a button shop. Next door, at the corner of Chestnut and Mill, stands Endeavor Masonic Lodge No. 17, established in 1851. We'll continue on Mill until we reach Federal Street. Here you might want to explore the architecture a bit more, or you might want to take a break at the Federal Street Espresso Bar. The Federal Street Espresso Bar and Gallery was built in 1901 as a Sussex Trust Bank, but over the years it has served as a school and various shops. Since it is brick, it was one of the few commercial buildings to survive the fire of 1909. As we leave the Espresso Bar, we'll turn right and walk a short distance to number 204 Federal Street, the Draper Atkins House. From here we can get a sense of the many examples of architecture found in the town. The Draper Atkins House is one of the three structures in town independently listed on the National Register. Built around 1840 and incorporating an 18th century core, the home is a late example of the classically inspired Federal style. On the opposite side of Federal Street, you will see two other examples of mid-19th century architectural styles. Number 203 was constructed by prosperous shipbuilder William C. Prettyman in the Italianate style, modeled after Italian villas. Right next door, number 205, the former home of Dr. Robert Hopkins, was built in the French-inspired Second Empire style. Note the mansard roof and the multicolored slate shingles. Both of these styles were highly fashionable in their day. Keep walking south until you notice the yellow house at number 305. Like number 308 across the street, it is an example of the predominant architectural style of Milton, the Victorian Gothic. Each has cross gables along the front, lancet-shaped windows, and elaborate trim, sometimes called gingerbread. This style was popular during the heyday of the shipbuilding era. The St. John the Baptist Episcopal Church, nearby, can trace its roots to an Anglican church built in 1728 in the forest, 2 miles south of Milton. The current structure dates to 1877, with the clinker brick veneer added in 1936. Now it's time to turn back toward the center of town. Stop when you reach number 111, a Queen Anne structure called the Holly House. The Holly House was built in about 1901. Note the shape, the turret, and the porch and windows. The building was the home of Charles Jones, a Milton entrepreneur called the Holly Man. The business sold to florists, churches, and department stores across the nation. Over 300 independent contractors, mainly country folk and farm families, created large and small holly wreaths, holly sprays, boxwood wreaths, and roping. The holly business originally operated out of buildings located behind the house along Strawberry Alley. Gladys Wilkins remembers women making holly wreaths when she was a child.
The holly, we have Mr. Jones, the holly wreath man, that one of the wreaths went to New York City, and then I think one time one went to Wanamaker's or Gimbel's in Philadelphia. The women did the holly business in the wintertime. They made holly wreaths at nighttime and sold them for extra money for Christmas.
From here, we'll continue north through town until we reach the Union Street commercial block, stopping briefly at the intersection of Front Street. At Front Street, turn right and walk a few steps until you reach the entrance of the fire department, facing the Broadkill River. About a mile to your right, where Cave Neck Road intersects Front Street, is the site of the old hosiery mill. The mill was established in the 1930s to produce silk stockings. With the onset of World War II, though, the mill owner switched to nylon. Nothing now remains except a cement pad. Closer to where you're standing, across the street and a bit to the right, is the site of one of Milton's chicken plants. This area was also home to the earlier shipbuilding industry. The Milton Volunteer Fire Department is an all-volunteer force founded in 1901. Sirens like the one you just heard have seen a lot of service over the past 70 or so years. Jack Hudson, a former Milton mayor and longtime fire department volunteer, tells us more about the siren.
And the siren that's at the firehouse is the original one.
From?
The beginning. That's the first fire siren that was in town. And it was from the 30s. And it's been rebuilt three or four times. It just wears out and it has a distinctive sound and we hate to buy a new one. Because the new one won't sound like that.
The fire department has been in the forefront of Milton's civic life for many years. Residents like Gladys Wilkins have especially fond memories of the fire department's role in providing a Merry Christmas for the community.
When I was sick with pneumonia, it was Christmas time. And, of course, at the time, there was the fire company. Always on Saturday, you took a can of canned goods, and you went to the theater, and that was your admission. A can of canned goods, and when it was over, the fire company was there with an orange and a little box of candy and candy cane. And I knew that I was not going to be able to do that, and that really, really bothered me. And that night, my sister's husband had his uncle, who was in the fire company, to bring the fire, it always makes kind of cry, to come out with the fire truck, and Santa Claus was on the fire truck. And that's, I think, my first thing of really Milton was the Santa Claus.
The Milton Theater was central to community life in Milton until the flood of 1962. We'll talk more about it just a bit later. But first, let's turn north again and walk towards the Union Street commercial area. On the way, we'll see the Noah Wiltbank McGee House at 102 Union Street. The Noah Wiltbank McGee House marks the beginning of the Union Street commercial block. The home is a mid-19th century Victorian Gothic with an 18th century rear core that is said to have been an early tavern. Noah McGee was one of Milton's most prominent shipbuilders and owners, building at least 16 vessels between 1846 and 1874. One, the schooner Annie McGee, built in 1859, was named for his 15-year-old daughter, Anna Hall McGee. Right next door to the McGee House is a store called the Jailhouse. In the mid-20th century, trials were held there on Friday and Saturday nights. Overall, the Union Street commercial block is a 1910 block of buildings that has housed a variety of stores in the past, including hardware, general stores, and grocery stores. The block is the site of an earlier wooden commercial block destroyed in the fire of 1909. A second fire followed in 1939. In 1962, a major flood again damaged the same commercial blocks. Martha Jane Donovan Burke tells us what downtown Milton was like when she was growing up.
When I was growing up, there were three grocery stores downtown, and there was hat shops, beauticians, and hardware stores, and a men's clothing store, and of course Sam's department store that had everything in it, and ice cream shops, and the post office was on Main Street, and all of those kinds of things, and it was much busier. People were more spread out in terms of the farms. And you had to come, it was like you came to town on Saturday night and Saturday do your shopping and do your business. And a lot of times they brought fresh foods to sell in the stores and things like that for the merchants. And a lot of people used to fish. And you could buy fresh fish downtown in the markets that they had gotten and brought in town to sell. So it was a lot different than it is now. I mean, you knew who owned the grocery store. You knew where the meat came from, what farmer killed the hog, and so forth and so on. And that was the way it was. A lot of bake sales with the homemade goods around, and it was fun. And I can remember my mother being very upset as the big, malls opened and the big grocery stores in Melford and Rehoboth and everything. Because she felt that everything should have been local here and you shouldn't have to get in the car and go to Milford to go grocery shopping. And I think I missed that because it really, when it kind of all deteriorated, it did present a problem. You had to go out of town to shop. That was it. We didn't have a grocery store for a while. And that was kind of foreign. It changed. And that the grocery store became a used furniture store, and post office built a new building, and it lost that cohesiveness that it used to provide.
Let's walk just a few steps north on Union Street and stop in front of the Milton Theater. The recently restored Milton Theater is at 108 Union Street. Built about 1912, it was remodeled as an Art Deco movie theater in the late 1920s. It now offers movies and live events, including theater. Martha Jane Donovan Burke remembers what the theater was like in the 1960s.
Of course, I went to the theater when it cost 50 cents to get in, 25 cents for a hamburger, and 10 cents for a Coke. And that was the Saturday night activity.
And where would you get the hamburger and the Coke?
In the little snack bar adjacent to the theater. Scotty had that. Ed Scott was his proper name. And he had the little snack bar, which was hooked onto the theater. And that's where we went on Saturday nights and watched a movie. And you went with your boyfriend and sat and held hands. And then there was Crouch's, which was at the end of the block, right on that little group of stores that sat out over in the water. They've been torn down now. But that had a jukebox in it and a little snack bar on the side. This was, I guess, in 60, 61, 62. And we would go in there on Saturday nights and eat ice cream and eat hamburgers and drink Cokes and dance to the music in the jukebox. And that was a lot of fun, too.
If we cross the street and take just a short walk north, we'll reach the Milton Library, once home to the town's button industry. While we're stopped at the library, let's imagine a time when the building was a full-blown button factory. Longtime resident Don Fisher knows a lot about that.
There were about three or four, at least four, good-sized button shops in Milton where the men walked to work and came home for lunch. This is where you went to work and cut buttons out of abalone shell. Came in here from Australia. And I'm very pleased to see that the museum has a full-scale button lathe. They punched them out with these lathes, and it was a tough way to make a living because all those guys had button dust, white button dust, and band-aids around their fingers. Shell would break and punch in there. But they were mainly, as I remember, the size of men's shirt buttons. They were just punched out of the shell and shipped to Philly to be, with the two holes to be drilled in the edge refined. Downtown where the library is, where the new addition is, there was a button outfit there called Libbencott's, but it had gone entirely bankrupt, and it was filled with, it was like a regular city-type factory, rows of button lathes. The windows were all broken out, but it was just left. And you see, if you go to the museum, you'll see the box, those button boxes from Australia. It says Produce of Australia. Well, those things were out of some kind of really tough, durable wood, and they were at least 7-quarter wood. I mean, it was 5-quarter. I don't know. It was heavy stuff. Boxes were heavy, and it's surprising. Best I can tell, they got that shell even all during the war. And the only thing I can figure is ships coming back from Australia were probably empty, so why not haul shell up here? So they did. And that's, the button shops would have had, beginning with the New Deal era and the Social Security Act, they would have had to pay workers' comp and unemployment insurance, all that good stuff. They literally took the lathes out of the button shops and put them in people's backyards in a structure that could be anything to look like an outhouse to something a little more elaborate. But then, guy could work at home, and even his wife got buttons. They wanted them.
Continuing just a few steps north on Union Street, we'll stop briefly at Welch's Drugstore at number 205, a vernacular structure built in the early 1880s for the Welch family and its business. Note the covered walkway and jigsaw trim details, both characteristic features of Milton's architecture. Welch's store, where we're standing now, was owned and operated by three generations of the family until its closing in the year 1988. It's a good example of the kinds of shops and stores that were scattered throughout Milton, with proprietors living in the same house, above, or adjacent to the shop. In addition to the downtown commercial blocks and the small shops which were scattered all over town, delivery wagons brought milk, ice, bread, and fish right to the door. Welch's store sold patent medicine. Everything from toothpaste to a diamond ring could be purchased here. Now let's cross the street and take a look at the millstone in the pavement at the southwest corner of Broad and Union. Tradition holds that the millstone was placed here in 1850 by a government surveyor. Broad Street is one of the two oldest streets in Milton. If you remember, Mill Street is the other. The street features a large collection of homes built around 1800 after land owned by William Peary was subdivided and put up for sale. The structures on Broad Street were typically three-bay houses, like the one at number 122. Many have later mid-19th century additions. The right bay of the Red House at 106 Broad Street, the Carey House, was built in about 1805. The Careys were a family of merchants and owned much of the land fronting Union Street. Hand-hewn cypress shingles on the ends and rear of the house, if not original, date to the 19th century. Cypress swamps were common in the area around Milton, especially in the Trap Pond area, and cypress was used as a building material until Teddy Roosevelt banned the cutting of cypress trees. The bright blue house you see further down the street dates from about 1805 and was the home of Nehemiah Laughlin. In 1802, Laughlin signed a petition against swine running loose in Federal Town. He signed another in 1811 to prevent hogs running loose. Laughlin, who operated a tannery, is listed as owning two houses and a lot in the tax assessment of 1809. The louvered shutters over solid shutters that you see on the home are typical of Sussex County architecture. Right across the lane is the home of ship carpenter Isaac White, also built around 1805. You might be surprised to see the use of modern colors. However, it's interesting to note that early 19th century colors were not always white or muted. Many were vibrant and rich. When you get to Reed Street, turn right. You are now on an early lane that gives a sense of Milton's past. The original lots were deep, but often narrow, extending from one street to the next to accommodate domestic animals, outhouses, sheds, and large vegetable gardens. As you may have noticed, Milton has many outbuildings. Summer kitchens, spring houses, and dog trots. Be sure to stop when you reach Tilney. At the corner of Reed and Tilney, you'll see an outbuilding built in about 1790 and said to have been used as a button-cutting cottage in the 20th century. As we've discussed, from the 1930s to the 1950s, backyard button-making sheds could be found all over town. Before we move on, take a look at the home built recently by Habitat for Humanity on the southeast corner. As you continue north on Reed Street, you'll see the rear of the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church. We'll stop nearby, where Reed intersects Clifton. We're at Reed and Clifton now. A church was built here in the late 1800s, and the current building was erected in the early 1900s. This congregation belongs to the denomination founded in Philadelphia by Richard Allen in 1787. Before the Civil War, this congregation's members may have been conductors on the Underground Railroad. While Milton has no documented Underground Railroad sites, its location on a waterway and its population of free blacks makes this an intriguing possibility. If you look across Mulberry Street, just past where the school is now, you'll see the former site of an extensive peach orchard called Chandler's Orchard. Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, who abdicated his position as King of the British Empire to marry an American divorcée, paid a visit here in 1944. At this time, he was governor of the Bahamas. As we learned earlier, many Bahamians served as farm laborers, and the Duke was on a tour to visit his subjects. While at Chandler's, he was serenaded with a chorus of God Save the King by laborers high in the fruit trees. Let's turn right and continue on Clifton to Union. Now that we're at Union Street, we'll want to turn left. Houses along the west side of the street were built in the late 18th and early 19th century. Of note is number 402, a recently restored late 19th century home on a site which earlier housed a school. Next door, at 404 Union, is an early 19th century home, thought to be the residence of E.L. Collins, a Milton blacksmith. Remnants of his trade are periodically uncovered at the rear of the property. If you'll turn now and face Atlantic Avenue, you can get a peek at what's left of one of Milton's former garment factories. It's about a block down on the north side of the street. Martha Jane Donovan Burke describes what it was like to work there.
A lot of garment factories. In fact, I worked, well, there are two of them that I remember. I worked in one of the garment factories one summer for Robert Hall Clothing. Made clothes for kids. I worked for Graves Manufacturing, turning collars, and the little tiny little girls' clothes we made that summer. And there was Bernstein's and Graves's right out there. And even my mother had worked for Graves's when she was a young lady.
Further out Atlantic is the road to Broadkill Beach, once known as the Poor Man's Riviera. Gladys Wilkins tells us what the beach was like when she was young.
We were lucky when we got down to Broadkill Beach. And Broadkill Beach used to be a very nice beach. People went there. The water was, you know, didn't have to worry about the ocean waves knocking you down. Oh, my, but, well, when I was young, of course, again, things were beginning to get better as I became even a teenager. You know, it was not, I only can say from what was in the past of my time of Broadkill, but there were nice cottages. It was the town's people mostly that had nice cottages down there, and it was a clean beach. They'd have cookouts down there. Now, 4th of July coming up, they'd have a big to-do down there. People, the men would go out fishing. They'd bring the fish in. They'd clean them, and they'd cook them right away down there. Yeah, and there used to just be, I don't remember the road because by my time it was more modern, but there was just a dirt road that took you into Broadkill Beach.
The corner of Atlantic and Union is also special to Miltonians because it is the beginning of the route for the town's very festive parades. We'll start the last leg of our tour now by walking down the east side of Union Street. Most houses on the east side of Union Street were built in the late 19th century. An exception is the Governor David Hazard Mansion, now Governor's Bed and Breakfast, at 327 Union Street. Let's stop here for just a moment. John Hazard, Governor Hazard's father, acquired his extensive estate bordering Union Street after the American Revolution, when Loyalist Boaz Manlove's estate was confiscated. The house is an 18th century core with early 19th century additions. You will also want to take a look at the Henry Ellingsworth House at number 326, across the street to your left. This house is rumored to have been a stop on the Underground Railroad, and is also thought to be haunted. Catherine Gregg, the current owner, talks about the spirit who might be living in her attic.
So when we came here on the day of closing and you do the little walkthrough, we go up into the attic. And the attic, when we looked at the house, was just packed full. And there, hanging on a clothes bar, were two bags. And I walked over, and they were two old suits, men's suits, and it had a note on the bag for us not to do anything with those suits, because when the original owner of the house, and it, I don't know if it was Ellingsworth or who, but when she died, she requested that these two suits never leave this house. We went to closing and got the keys, and we came back, and Dick starts upstairs with a trash bag. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going up there. I'm throwing those suits out. I said, no, you're not. And those suits are still in that attic today. And I go up there and brush up by them and everything. And honestly, there are times when I feel that there's someone up there with me. Not a evil spirit, but someone who is happy to know that there are people living in this house now that care about it. I do. I have these feelings. And I'm not a person who believes in, you know, ghosts and all that sort of things, but I have that feeling about this house.
A short walk towards town, and we'll reach the Robert Hood Carey House at number 301 Union. We'll stop there. We're standing now at 301 Union Street, the childhood home of Joseph Maul Carey, one of Wyoming's first senators and later governor. An early 19th century house with late 19th century additions, the home is one of several in Milton that are rumored to have been stops on the Underground Railroad. The carriage house on this property is unique in Sussex County. Ken Brittingham, whose parents bought the house from the Carey family, tells us what he has heard about his home's history.
From the time that we bought the home from the Careys, my mother and father were told that this was the room that was part of the Underground Railroad. Now, it was just part of the transference of the property that they got that information. And so, as we grew up in the property, we were always led to believe that this was part of the Underground Railroad. But on the flip side of that, we don't have any documented evidence. And I guess the thing that stands in question is when my mom and dad bought the property, they had no knowledge nor interest. We had limited information at the time about the historic significance of the buildings. And so that information was transferred to my family and remains to this day.
Right across the street is the site of King's Homemade Ice Cream. Originally the Robert Hood Carey Store, this is an 1820s commercial structure with late 19th century alterations. It is the oldest continuously used commercial building in Sussex County. On your way back to the Milton Historical Society, take a look at 214 Union. This house was moved from another site to its present location. Such house moving was quite common in the Milton area. It was usually done with a log and pulley system under man or mule power. Now that you've finished the tour, we know you'll want to spend some time in the museum to see our exhibits and visit the gift shop. We'd also like very much to answer your questions and listen to your comments. Come back and see us when you can, and visit our website frequently, www.historicmilton.org.